Oh, good.
Well, hopefully, and we will do the, I will chant the verses. And then I'll unmute everybody in case anybody has anything they'd like to say. So again, I hope that some of us are still memorizing the 37 practices. We're a third of the way through. It's a lot of verses, but it's definitely possible to, if we, with work, with effort, it's possible to have them all in mind, instantly accessible to us. And if that's not what you aspire to do, to at least learn what each practice is, so that if I were to say what's practice for, you could say to let go of attachment to this lifetime. And then if you ever meet Khandra Rinpoche and she asks you, what are the 37 practices, which apparently she asks her students, she expects them to actually know them, then you can just reel them off: to study, contemplate, and meditate, to leave my homeland, to rely on solitude, and so forth. That is a worthy aspiration, and it's not that hard. It's just a few lines. So we'll chant the verses now. This precious human life's so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat, to navigate samsara's endless sea, and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night, to study, contemplate, and meditate, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I can remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness a guest will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims, not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. to strive in all our efforts just for that. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother is each and every sentient being. Since time without beginning cared for me, how can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If someone driven by intense desire steals all my wealth or instigates the theft, to dedicate to them from all three times my wealth, good deeds, and merit, everything, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So this is our verse for today. We'll chant it another time. I'm really trying to tune in to the meaning and the feeling of what it would feel like. Though I've not done the slightest thing that's wrong, without a cause someone cuts off my head, to generate compassion in my heart and take upon myself all their misdeeds, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So here we are. I'm gonna unmute people just in case anybody would like to say anything before we go on. We're gonna be on verse 13 today, which is to repay. I've changed the translation a couple of times to repay.
Stop.
To repay unfairness or repay injury with acceptance, also known as taking, how to use suffering. So anybody have anything they would like to say or ask before we delve into today's verse? Okay. And again, Danny, can we hear you? I hope. I don't think we can hear you. Do you want to type it? And we can all take a mental break while Fanny is typing and just let our minds come to rest. Okay. Okay. We can do the phone again anytime. Feel free to give me a call, Fanny, if you want to have, if you want to be heard. Sorry that it's not working out today. So if there's nobody else, then we'll just mute everybody again. Namdak, was that you wanting to say something?
No.
Okay. All right. Everybody's being muted again, but you can signal me or unmute yourself as always if needed. So I wanted to say two things. One is, why we chant that. I don't know how people feel about using our precious time to chant the verses as we have more and more verses. And again, we may sail it back again at various points. But I think it's really important for us to chant the verses together. And I don't know like what your practice is at home. I hope people are chanting them at home. Every day would be really good. But in case you're not finding the time to do that, I think it's good to chant through all of them, you know, once a week, to just be reminded of all the practices we're engaging in, which is like now it's 13 practices, all cumulative and all ongoing. And I wanted to tell a little story that Anne might have been there and might remember when we studied the 37 practices in New Hampshire back, you know, gosh, 15 years ago, I guess. And we had the Tibetan, and we had Kempo Sultram Jamso's book, which has the Tibetan and the English. And I made everybody chant the Tibetan every week. And we had this elderly man, he passed away in 2004, he was a lovely person, Wim Frank, a Dutch man, and he was so, like, he was so patient with everything, but he just broke when we chanted the 37 verses. I mean, you know, as it went on, it was more and more verses, and it was chanted in Tibetan, and, you know, he couldn't relate to that at all. And so in the middle of the chanting one day, you know, some weeks in, he just stood up and said, "Why do we have to do this?" And I can't remember if I think I made everybody still chant, you know, all the way to the end. I can't really remember. But anyway, why do we do this? It's really important. The repetition is really important. And I'm remembering also the other story that I remember about it is when Kempo Sultram jumped. So back in the early days when he would come to KTC in the 1980s, I think this was in the 80s that he taught the 37 practices. I was there every year. And he would come in the old days, he would come for like a couple of weeks and he would teach something really profound. And he would do it because it was the only Western center that had three-year retreat graduates. He started coming in 1985, the year that, like, right after, like literally right after the first retreat came out, like just a few weeks after they came out of retreat, he was there. And so like the second, third, or fourth year, sometime along then, he taught the 37 practices and he made us chant. We chanted, we would chant the verses and he would make individuals chant. He would point, like whatever verse we were studying, point at somebody and say, "You chant it," in Tibetan. And then at the end, we'd all have to chant all the verses in Tibetan. It had a really nice, really simple tune, which I wish I remembered. But that's how important it is. Like Kempo Sultram Jomso Rinpoche, whose every word was so profound, he really insisted on using some of our time with him to chant these verses every time, every session, two sessions a day, every day, we chanted all the verses. So it's important. And if anybody is not enjoying that part of it, you know, please bear with us. So, yes, Patrick, I'm going to unmute you.
I've got somebody coming at 2:30.
Okay, do our best.
Get up and going at that time.
I'm sorry?
I'll be getting up and going, leaving.
Okay, well, hopefully we will end at that time, too. I don't want you to have to miss anything. Technically, you should be ending by then. Thanks for letting me know. So the other thing I wanted to say before we launch into our study is that put it in the email, but you know, it can be a lot of emails and I don't know if people end up reading all of them. But we talked about this a few verses ago and I can't find the reference in Dingo Chense Rinpoche's book because I don't have my book with me and it's hard to flip through a Kindle, where he mentioned Chö and the water offering practice Chutor as ways in which we offer, you know, our body to all beings. And so, and I mentioned once before that if there are people who have had the Chö empowerment, and I know some people here have had it, if anybody wants to get together one time for a separate class on how to apply Chö within the context of the 37 practices, I'm very happy to offer that. I have a couple of takers. So just let me know about you. Is that you volunteering, Namdok? Okay, so Namdok. So anyway, I'll put Namdok on the list. And if you want to, if you have had the Chö empowerment, that's an absolute prerequisite. And you want to participate in like a 1 hour class on how to use the short Chö practice. It's a short Chö practice that I would send you, a short translation. Then we'll set up a time that works for all of us. Okay. So, we have a contemplation. Let's talk about that first. I could do it on my phone. I can read the exact contemplation, that would be useful. I hope everybody had a chance to read that and do that this week. Okay, it's coming up. Slowly. So anyway, the first contemplation is based on Ken MacLeod's commentary. I don't know if everybody has that. So here it is. This is what I asked you to think about this week, the first of two contemplations. So Ken MacLeod says in his commentary, and there's a whole section that we may have time to read through, just that section today, about how when somebody does something to us that we don't deserve, somebody harms us in a way that we feel we don't deserve. We haven't done anything. We didn't do anything at all, and somebody comes down on us, like really hard. The first thing that tends to come to our mind is that's not fair. And Ken talks about the meaning of that, that feeling of unfairness and some of the connotations it has. But he says, he advises us as practitioners, as bodhisattva practitioners, drop any concern for justice and fairness. These are ideals, ideas that your patterns, your habitual patterns, easily twist and shape to their own ends. Practice goes nowhere if you follow this path. You are soon lost in interpretation, conceptual thinking, unacknowledged prejudice, and bias. So the first question, what does Ken mean by this? And do you think he's right? I mean, we're allowed our own opinion on this topic. But when he says, I just want to say, when he says you are soon lost in interpretation, conceptual thinking, unacknowledged prejudice, and bias, who is it who thinks it's unfair? That's the question that Lama Narla Rinpoche would have asked back in the old days. Like, who's thinking that? Who's thinking it's unfair? And what happens if you then respond to the person, that's not fair? What you get is a completely different perspective on the situation. Like, they're not going to agree with you that it's not fair. So is it fair or is it not fair? And I think some things are obviously not fair. You know, when you get into social justice issues, for example, some things are definitely not fair and should change. But he's telling us, in the context of practice, drop that. Don't even think about that. So is he right? What does he mean? And is he right? And if nobody has a thought on that, that's fine. We'll go on to the next thought. But anybody have any thoughts on that? Do people generally agree with it? Or I think it's a hard one. Valerie, did you want to say something?
I just agree with that.
Yeah. I think it's important to say in the context of practice, but when are we not practicing? Like, when are we supposed to not practice? To let go of practice. Yes, Marilyn, I'm unmuting you.
I don't think I'm on yet.
Yes, you are.
Okay, the only thing that I mean, I had a lot of trouble thinking about this one.
Yeah.
And the only thing I can think of that makes it okay for me is the part that comes later, and I can't remember whether it's in Dingo Tenshi or who, what about what am I going, where is my mind going to be if I'm going to have a reaction? And if it's going to be in anger or, you know, not fair, you know, it's not going to have a, I'm not going to have a clear kind of response. So yeah. It was really difficult. And when I was in a really bad situation where people at my department wrote nasty letters about me to the university president, the only thing I could do was think that a demon got them. That was like the only way I could think of to not like go majorly ballistic.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like, that's a demon and got him.
Right. But that's exactly Gunpopa's advice, right? That's his first advice is like, think they're not in control of themselves. They're drunk. I think a demon's good. That's a demon. What's the other, like, what's the first thing that Dingo Chensei tells us to think when we think, when this thing happens to us, when this unfair thing happens, what's another place? It's Gunpopa's second place we go. First place is they're drunk or they were invaded by a demon. Second place, what are we bringing to this situation?
Our that karma.
Caused it to happen, our karma. Yes, Valerie was going to say that too. Valerie.
I was going to say our ego.
Yeah, ego, karma. Yeah, ego, definitely. That's you know, when I have one of my posts is 18 ways to catch ego clinging in the act. Feeling that you've been treated unfairly is one, whether it's true or not. Because if you didn't have ego clinging, you wouldn't care. ego, you know, being free of ego clinging is being free of the eight worldly concerns. And this is one set of the concerns, praise or blame, criticism, people finding you wrong, people, you know, finding fault with you. You don't care if you don't have any ego in the game. So ego clinging is a good answer and karma is a good answer. We should always remember that when bad things happen to us, and I'm going to unmute you, when bad things happen to us, one of the first things to remember is our karma. We're paying off karma. And then it turns into something we could actually rejoice about if we can't change the situation. And
I struggle with this all the time too. And I, even when I say all those things to myself in the moment when something's happening and I'm thinking not fair, it's like this wall. And it's like, I don't care if it's not fair. It's not fair. You know, I don't care if it's my ego or any, I can't seem to break through that wall to soften, you know. Yeah. I just cling on to it. And I don't know if anyone has any suggestions to help with that.
Mine is lather, rinse, repeat. You know, it's like we have to keep doing it again. It's like it's beating your head against a wall.
Yeah.
It really is. And remember what Ken said in the last chapter, the last verse, is this is not a feel-good practice. It's not necessarily going to make us feel better. We have to keep doing it because it's going to break us out of a pattern that's causing this wall to exist in the first place. But what's it like to dismantle a wall? You can do it, brick by brick, if you have the right tools. Yes. Dan, I don't know if I saw you. I did. I saw Dan first, so I'm going to go to Dan first and then Kathy. Okay, Dan.
Good. Yeah, I had an interesting thing happen last week after we met. I got like a little, you know, my email notice on my phone like 30 seconds after we ended practice. And I noticed I got my hours cut at work in half. So out of nowhere. Yeah, so it was like all this kind of like, right, you know, going from how I felt like, you know, meeting always is such a nice feeling afterwards to like right here with what we're studying, you know. And of course, my boss is like, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. You know, I adjusted everyone's schedule, but I definitely got kind of the shaft of everything. So, yeah, it kind of stinks, but.
That feels, and Fanny's saying that happened to her too.
Yeah, but it made me kind of, like, I started to think about how, like, I'm being freed of some maybe past negative karma or, yeah, and it changed, you know, and I worked with it when I sat, so.
But it still feels bad, right? I mean, you can work with it in the moment, but it's still there. Like, the thing is still there. You just lost half your day. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Letting my boss know about it was like, I think she took offense to it. Like,
to what? To you objecting to it or to?
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit. And I was just like, oh, you know, okay.
So in the context of this, Kathy's waiting to speak. Sorry. Unmute. Okay, Kathy, I think you're on.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
I've had a couple of these startling things where, you know, after 40 years, somebody said something like, you know, she literally couldn't stand me for 40 years. And I have had a couple of these over the years. And the only thing that has worked that I can do is know that if I just look at it as my karma, and the demon thing is good. I just knew she was ill. She died like the year later. I knew it's like the kidneys are, it's toxins building up. But the feelings, you just have to give them time. It's like you can't rush that out of your system. It's a shock to your system when it's something that, you know, crazy. And then, but if you give it some time and don't expect it to change immediately, it will lessen. And that's the only thing that I have found with these, you know, really startling things that seem so unfair and out of nowhere, out of nowhere. So anyway, that's mine.
Clearly it happens to all of us. We all have experience in this.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Did you have anything else, Kathy?
No.
Okay. Right. And I just wanted to say, time is, you know, time is necessary, and that's why we need patience. We're applying patience, but also we do have tools to work with this. And saying, but it's still, the wall is still there, and it is, but doesn't mean we shouldn't use the tools, even though they don't dismantle the wall right away. The tools give us a way to speed up the process. And they really are, you know, if you can go to taking and sending, it feels unfair. I'm just going to breathe in my feeling that it's unfair and breathe out relaxation and acceptance to myself. I'm going to breathe in this other person's treating me badly and whatever's making them do it, that demon, you know, or whatever it is. Those things do help, but they don't make it go away. And that's why Lavitz repeat. You know, that's what practice is. It's not like you do it once. And Tibetan Buddhism is full of like the promise that you do it once and it's over. You know. So if a being hears Om Mani Padme Hum one time, they will become Buddha. Well, it's not the whole story. It's just meant as an encouragement, I think. It plants a seed, but it doesn't. And all of our remedies, they plant seeds, but they don't solve the problem on the spot unless we're just ripe at that moment. And that can happen too. You know, you can be just ripe at that moment and it does it. Like you just sit with the emotion and wham, it's gone and it doesn't come back. That can happen. But more often you sit with the emotion and you get a moment of clarity and then it comes back, you know, more thoughts. And then you have to do it again. Lav, the rinse, repeat. So that's our practice. And it brings to mind the 16th Karmapa's, you know, quote, the quote from the 16th Karmapa that circulates on Facebook sometimes. Just keep going. That's the practice of a bodhisattva or something like that. Practice of a bodhisattva is to just keep going. So anybody have anything else to say before I go on to the rest of the contemplation? All right. So then, like, so what does he mean by this? And is he right? Like, I think Marilyn, you know, hit the nail on the head with, we don't want to be reacting. It's not helpful if we react from a perspective or situation, a state of mind that's been taken over by, you know, a negative emotion. I mean, then we have the demon. Like, they have the demon and then we have the demon. So it's two demons battling. Nobody's going to get anywhere. But if one person's a demon, you know, inhabited by a demon, and one person has a completely clear mind, progress can be made, I think. It may not get you your job back or, you know, whatever the problem is. But you can address the situation then from a framework of clarity. And that's what Ken McLeod says that at the end of his commentary. He comes back to the fairness question and says that's the point. We need to clarify our own mind first. So Dharma practice always comes first. And that's what he's saying here is, you know, forget fairness and justice. Make sure that you're not caught up in your habitual patterns. That's your first job as a bodhisattva. And obviously, if there's like an earthquake and there's people dying out there, then you run. You don't take time to go sit and meditate to make sure you're reacting in the right way. You go out and help people if it's an emergency. But you can take that moment. You can just, as you're running, you know, to help somebody, you can take that moment mentally to just let things settle, to let your emotional reactivity settle, and then you're in a better position to help out. And I think that's the point. So then that brings the question, and this is what he addressed at the end of his commentary. Should we ever intervene in situations to combat unfairness or abuse? And if the answer is yes, and I think it is yes, I mean, does anybody think we shouldn't? Does anybody think that's what Ken's saying, like you should never help anybody? Is being treated unfairly. The point is, like, we can do it within the context of our practice, but we have to go to practice first. Like, our mind has to go to that practice space first. As we're rushing to help the person who's been run over by a car, we're doing taking and sending. We're letting our own emotional reactivity just sort of drop away as best we can, and we're lather, rinse, repeating, you know, because maybe it comes back again and again, and we just keep doing it. We keep doing it. All right, so the homework for this week and forever, from now on that we have this verse, is to be vigilant for the feeling that you are being treated unfairly. Dan was really lucky. He got that like right after class last week. But sorry about your job, Dan. I know that that's a problem. Be vigilant for the feeling that you're being treated unfairly. It happens a lot. It happens to me. I had an incident at the botanical garden some weeks ago that was, this is when I had the idea to keep a journal, like of a journal of adversity or something like that. A log of adversity. Like, this happened and this is what I should have done. This is what a bodhisattva would do. But it was just a stupid, stupid little thing that I go to the botanical garden several times a week. I'm a longtime member, and I'm walking in, and there's a few people around, and the woman behind the counter didn't see me. She saw somebody else coming from another door, and I got there first. Like, I was coming from one door. This person was coming from another door, but she had caught their eye, and I get right there, right in front of her, and she says, no, these people were first, and she makes me back up. And as it happened, I was in a hurry that day. I didn't have much time. And these people were like doing something like, you know, buying a membership. It was going to take a long time. And I just turned around and laughed. I was like really like in a snit. Like, that was so unfair. And as soon as I get outside, and I know, I see it happening. It's like my mind is thinking this thing. And I'm reacting. I'm caught in a reaction that's like just stupid. Because she saw what she saw. And who cares? It's like so trivial. But it took a little while for it to evaporate, and I had to keep coming back to, you know, who cares? Like, it's not important, you know. So we all have experience with it all the time. So I've not kept the log yet, but mentally I keep the log. Mentally I go, okay, this is another one for the log. And I could write 3 or 4 things in the log a day. So let's be especially alert now for feeling something is unfair, because if we have that in our mind, that framework, then it'll make it easier for us to remember the practice. It's like, oh, unfairness, right, that's verse 13. I know what to do. I know what to think, and I know what to do. So there was another contemplation, which is coming up. So there's a contemplation from Dingo Chense Rinpoche's commentary, and we'll go through this somewhat quickly, but I do welcome comments. For example, you might find yourself, okay, this is a different situation. Like, Dan really had his income cut back, or, you know, things really do happen to us that are unfair and that hurt us. And so this is how we respond. This verse is about how we respond to those things. But sometimes it's our own mind playing a trick on us. So Dingo Chense says, for example, you might find yourself suddenly face to face with someone you think wants to harm you, and a strong feeling of fear would arise. But once you realize that the person, in fact, has only good intentions toward you, your fear would disappear. It was just a thought. I mean, how many times does that happen? You know, maybe, you know, people who live in a city like DC or New York City. I know when I lived in New York City, it would happen. Like, I'd be on a street and somebody would be coming towards me and I think, oh my God, oh no. And they're just passing, like, you don't even notice me. I once, you know, when I lived in Brooklyn and I worked as a typesetter, like I worked the night shift and I'd get home at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And one time I came home, I was walking home from the subway, and it's a desolate area. It was on the edge of Park Slope back in the early 80s, around 1980. And there's this group of young men with like baseball bats, and they just look like they're up to no good. And I'm like, oh my God, I have to walk right past them. They're going to like at least like say nasty things. And I was like totally braced for it. And they didn't even know I was going by. They didn't even see me. They didn't care. I wasn't interesting to them. But I had that reaction. I had a reaction to be afraid and to brace myself. Yes, and Fanny, especially now with the random act of violence where 8 people were killed, or the random act of violence in Las Vegas where 59 people were killed. You know, yes, you don't know, like, what's going to happen to you. But those people were not, they didn't have time to be afraid. You know, they were riding their bicycles, and suddenly they're gone. Beautiful weather, suddenly they're gone. So that's just a reminder that we can't take any moment for granted. But so there are those times, and as I said in my post, this tends to happen to me with written communications, like emails, especially when I was at KTC, and there's like a billion emails and a billion texts a day, and it seems like somebody has a tone, or they're saying something, and it turns out to just be your own interpretation, like you didn't read it carefully, and even when you go, you fume about it all day, and you go back and you reread the thing, and it's like it didn't say that. It didn't even say that. You wasted the whole day being upset about something that never happened. So the Tibetans have a classic, it's a little bit of a deeper example, but it works here too. It's like when you, and this is from India basically, that you see a snake and it turns out to be a rope. You know, you're in fear of your life, you're terrified, you're sweating, and it turns out to be a piece of rope. So much of life is like that too. So those are two things we can keep in mind. Like, A, does it matter if I'm being treated unfairly? My karma is being paid off. This person is inhabited by a demon. This is a passing thing. Number one, like how to deal with the actual situation. And number two, you have to ask yourself, am I interpreting this correctly? Like, am I really getting what the other person is saying to me? Or am I laying over it some preconception that I have or some misunderstanding? And that's worth clearing up too. And again, team other. Like, we put ourselves as bodhisattvas, we put ourselves in the other person's shoes. We try to do that and really genuinely drop our preconceptions and see from their point of view, see from their suffering, see what they're up against, whatever it is that's making them treat us unfairly. So those are a couple of ways we can think about it, about this situation of, I didn't do anything wrong and somebody's cutting off my head. Anybody have any other comments on that before we look over the commentaries for a few minutes? So I'm assuming that everybody reads the Dingo Chensei every week, and so you've read it and you know what's in it. And if you're not finding time to read it, I urge you to please do so, because it will really help. We don't get to discuss everything in class, plus being exposed to it more than one time, it goes in a lot deeper and you see things. You see things that you don't see with just a cursory reading or just hearing about it in class. How many people do not have the Ken MacLeod book? Okay, so a couple of people don't have it. So, you know, we'll keep bringing it in class, and I post from it too. It's a very good commentary, but the Dingo Chensei is the main one that I hope everybody has and is reading. So we're going to look briefly at three commentaries today if we have time. We will be done by 2:30, that's a promise. So Dingo Chensei's first point is, it's important to remember that this is the result of your own past actions when something bad happens. This applies to all adversity. It's in Gampopa's chapter on patience. Always remember karma. Like, something bad happens, I did something. It's so liberating. You don't then have to worry about anything. You don't have to, you know, analyze it, who did what to whom. You can just give it all up and think, okay, karma is paid off. And it really relaxes the mind to think that. he sums up what we should do, and I think it's very beautifully put and it's very comprehensive. If you see someone doing something negative, including something directed against us, which is the point of this verse, think of all the suffering he is accumulating for himself. You know, this is if somebody's doing it to us through malice in some way. Think of all the suffering he or she is accumulating for him or herself, and pray that, rather than being reborn in the lower realms, the results of his negative actions may come upon you instead, and dedicate to him the results of your own positive actions. And I unpack this in the blog post, but, you know, just to, that's three things. That's not just like a nice, let's do some taking and sending. That's three things. And in this one particular case, I don't agree with Ken's translation of this verse. He says something like, take on all their venom. But, and maybe he means something deeper by that. All of the other translations say misdeeds or negativity, whatever it is, negative deeds or misdeeds. We're not only accepting their negative emotions that are flying at us, but we're aspiring to go beyond that, to take on all of their negative karma, everything they've done to anybody in the past, present, and future. May it ripen in me. This is a really heavy aspiration. May all of this person's negative karma ripen in me. Can we make that happen? No. So no worries. No worries. What it's doing is it's expanding our capacity. It's expanding our capacity to react in the moment in a constructive, compassionate way. So somebody's done something to harm you, somebody's cut off your head. Okay, fine, I'm going to just bear it with patience. Demon, karma, whatever. I'm going to take all of their negative karma, not only all their suffering and all their negativity, but all their karma onto myself. May it ripen for me. And we're not done yet. And we're also going to send them, dedicate to them all of our merit, all the good stuff. Like, let them have it instead of me. Let them have it. Again, this is our mind training. This is not actually going to happen. Zhangong Kongpo assures us in the chapter on karma in Torch of Certainty that we cannot experience somebody else's negative actions. The karma of somebody else's negative actions is not. The laws of the universe make that impossible. We can only experience karma that we have incurred ourselves. So this is a wish. It's an aspiration that we're making. And by making this aspiration in a heartfelt way, we are expanding our limits. We are transcending our limits. And we're getting closer to the four limitless aspirations. So it's for us. It's actually for us that we're doing all of this. But it also helps the other person because we're not sending that energy back at them. We are just absorbing their energy and their negativity. And that changes, as I've said, that changes the dynamic. Sometimes the dynamic is really strong on the other side and they don't notice, but it does change it. And even if it's only our own mind that then becomes peaceful, very worthwhile practice. So I'm not going to go into this now, but Dingo Chenzi spins the second part of his commentary talking about ego clinging. Like this whole concept of I being really the source of all of our suffering. And somebody brought that up earlier, ego, that was Valerie, that it's ego that makes us feel it's unfair. It's all about thinking that we have a fixed, permanent, definite, identifiable, continuous identity that's the same from moment to moment, and therefore that is actually being harmed in some lasting way by the unfairness. But we know as Buddhists that everything is always in flux. Everything's always changing. There is no fixed self there. And we're going into that deeply through Ornament of Precious Liberation at KDC right now. So this teaching fits right in with what we're doing at KDC. And he actually has, so at the end, at the very end of the commentary, and I really urge everybody to really study this, he sums up what this I really is, this sense of self, this ego really is. And we've heard this before, but it's very well put here. He says, I is merely a label you have given through no fault of your own, to a transient combination of concepts and attachments to your body, speech, and mind. It's the skandhas. It's like you can't, it changes from moment to moment. It's heaps and heaps of different parts. There's no unity to it. There's no unified self. It's just a label. And he says, and this is also very powerful, use any practice you do to dissolve this idea of I and the self-oriented motivations that accompany it. All of our practice, when we do Chenrezig, we're visualizing ourselves as Chenrezig. Like the I that we usually think we are is gone. When we do Tara, same thing. When we do Mahakala, we don't usually visualize ourselves as Mahakala, but we become Chenrezig or whoever our teacher gave us to be. So through those practices, we're cutting through the sense of I. Through the Chir practice, we are giving away everything, like as food. Giving away this I. Through meditation, we unseat ourselves, you know, or as Trungpa Rinpoche puts it, meditation is a process of decentralization. Like we become less focused on this identity we have. Our self expands to permeate the whole limitless space of the universe. So keep that in mind. Use any practice you do to dissolve this idea of I, that I exist as a fixed, continuous, identifiable thing. And make this, we could make this, as we did with something else a few weeks ago, thanks to Patrick, We can make this our koan this week, our contemplation. Like, just look for that. We're looking for feeling like we're being treated unfairly, but let's also look for moments when we identify as a self that isn't really there. Like, how can we see this in a different way? Can we disidentify in this moment of struggle or this moment of anything, of washing dishes, of whatever we're doing? Can we let go of that sort of centralized focus and just expand our sense of who and what we are? So that is Dingo Chensei's commentary, and it's another one of those chapters I feel it's worth reading a few times, especially the second half where he talks about the emptiness of self. We're going to, oh yeah, John, I'm going to unmute you. I'm having trouble unmuting for some reason. Okay, you're not unmuted. Can you unmute yourself? Because it's not happening for me. Okay.
There you go. So anyway, I was thinking, I see how it reinforces, you know, this unfairness reinforces the concept of there's an I.
Yeah.
But wouldn't, doesn't taking on the suffering of others, now I'm taking on their suffering, that's not the same?
What you're doing is getting right at the heart of taking and sending, which is really great. What do we do, like, when we breathe in the suffering, what do? Do we take it on to ourself? We don't, actually. We breathe it into our heart center, which I usually describe as our bodhicitta, our vast, limitless Buddha nature. We breathe it into that, and that's who we are. That's who we are. It's like Buddha nature, our vast Buddha nature, emptiness, luminosity, and continuity, or uninterruptibility, or whatever we want to call it. That's our real self, but it's not a self in the sense of this limited I. So if we could really breathe in other people's suffering and taking and sending, we would get sick. Like if we would breathe in somebody's cancer, we would get cancer. But we're not breathing it into this fake I, this relative I. We're breathing it into the big, limitless I. Does that answer the question?
Yes, that was perfect, because that was, put it into words, what's been discussed, basically, or not said out loud, out loud, but yes, excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the question, John. Anybody else? All right, so we're going to look at Ken MacLeod for a minute. We won't get to Geshe Jampa Tegchok, but basically, I put it in my post, the part of that one that I thought was really helpful. He's doing very short commentaries on these Bodhisattva boot camp verses. right, I see that Patrick, actually, of course, if he has a 2:30 appointment, he has to leave a little early. So, bye, Patrick. What was I saying? Oh, Geshe Jampa Tegchok. What I included in my post from his commentary, which I thought was the most important part that the other commentaries really didn't address so directly, is it was one of the parts of the contemplation that I gave in the post, is that it doesn't mean that we don't intervene to fix situations when we have to prevent harm especially. But we want to do it from that point of view, that place of not being caught up in emotional turmoil ourselves. So that's what this is all about. It's taming our mind. These verses are about taming our own mind. So Ken says, let's see, I'm just going to go through some of the things I highlighted. He talks very eloquently about when something like this happens to us, like it kind of shocks our system. And as even as practitioners, we oscillate. You know, we think, oh God, it's so unfair. How could they do this? And then we go to our practice. Right. Oh, right. Karma. It's my karma. And then it comes back and we find ourselves deep in that emotional reaction again. And we apply the remedy again. When we find ourselves caught up in the emotion, which we inevitably will be again and again, he says, you are lost in reaction. What do you do? And that's one of the things I love about Ken's commentaries, is from a very Western point of view, same as ours, he gives very practical advice about how to deal with these kinds of situations that come up in the verses. He says, again, Tokmei Zangpo suggests taking and sending. it's the answer to everything. You can never go wrong with taking and sending. There are other remedies. And Marilyn and I in particular have talked about sometimes taking and sending really doesn't seem to do the job in a particular situation, but what may do the job, because that's the relative bodhicitta. If you remember, and it's worth reviewing this, we've been given two ways. Dingo Chenzi did this a few chapters back, and it was verse 11. When we find ourselves overwhelmed by emotions, there's two basic remedies. One of them is the relative bodhicitta remedy, taking and sending. Love and compassion. Take in their suffering, send them love, compassion, happiness. But there's another one. And especially if the first one just doesn't feel right in that moment, you go straight to just resting the emotion, like let it wash over me. Or as Trungpa Rinpoche said, become the anger. Become the anger. You just let it have you, but you drop the story. You just, what you're letting have you is the feeling, like the racing pulse and the tight chest and the, want to kill somebody feeling. But you, if you let go of the storyline, you're just left with this really interesting feeling. And so you can rest in that. So those are the two methods that we want to apply. So here he's saying, let's go to taking and sending. Like something bad happened, I'm totally in turmoil. Let's go to taking and sending. And he says, take in the venom of anger from this person and from all beings. Like all this anger that this person's feeling, I'll take it in, and I'll take in everybody's anger. This is, you know, a practice we've talked about before. And send out understanding and love. Take in the pain of rejection. Send out your joy of acceptance. Take in loss and fear. Send out your wealth and confidence. Still the stories run. It isn't fair, you think. You reconstruct in your mind what likely happened, how you ended up being fired for something you did not do. But it is too late. The world has moved on. You are where you are, and it is not fair. So when you find yourself in that place, and that's the homework assignment, is look for that. As soon as you feel, oh, that's not fair, from all beings everywhere, take in all the unfairness they encounter. Okay, I'm feeling unfairly treated. Let me take in the unfairly treatedness of all sentient beings. Everybody is being treated unfairly. Take in the lack of understanding and the pain of those, also of the ones who are being unfair, judgmental, critical, and punitive. And send out equanimity, impartiality, patience, and understanding. So Ken asks, what leads you to focus on fairness? As you practice and feel the part of you that wants justice and fairness, you may be surprised at how young it feels. And isn't it like that? He says it is often a child's wish, a child's reaction, a child who has yet to come to terms with the unpredictable topsy-turvy chaos that is life. There's one of the... A Dharma practitioner at the monastery often says, that's not fair. And it always feels like a 10-year-old child. That person has reverted to childhood. But you respect the feeling, like you're not judging yourself and saying, oh, I shouldn't be feeling like it's unfair because that, you know, that's so childish. You go, this feels really unfair. And then you apply your remedies. You do taking and sending, or you do resting in the emotion. So he goes on a bit, and he talks about how if for a moment, taking and sending can do this for us, we can suddenly shift perspectives and see from the other person's point of view, then we realize that they are treating us unfairly from a position of suffering on their own part. Something wrong there, maybe they're, you know, possessed by a demon, or drunk, or mentally ill, whatever it is, or just caught up in their own anger. And so he says, through the taking and sending, you can feel their pain too. You take her pain into your pain, along with the pain of everyone who is hurt or confused by the unpredictable ways of the world, and you send to them the warmth of your love, the gentle touch of your patience, and the peace of your equanimity in the face of the inevitable inequities of life. Inevitable inequities. It happens all the time. We can't get away from this. The world is never going to be a better place. It's just not. It's never been a better place, really. People have always been this unhappy and this mean and this, you know, polarized. Ancient Greece, ancient Rome. it's not going to get better. So that's where he says drop any concern for justice and fairness. For one thing, because it's not probably, it's not going to change it for all time. But we may be able to intervene in a particular situation to prevent some kind of harm from happening. And so we try to do that with a clear mind. But basically, just give up the thought that the world is ever going to, we're going to solve all the problems. We're not. And it's really a waste of energy for that to be your focus without bringing the Dharma to it. Your first focus has to be the Dharma as a Dharma practitioner. Doesn't mean you can't work for social justice. There are people out there doing very good work from a Dharma perspective, but they're also working on taming their own mind and on reacting from a from love and compassion rather than from anger and hate. So he says, use taking and sending to open to the totality of pain and suffering in the world and take it in. Use it to open to the totality of joy and happiness in you and send it out. Practice this until all thought and projection fall away and you are clear and awake in the experience of taking and sending. And if you're doing it in a really focused way, and I'm not always there myself, but I do know this to be true, if you persist in the practice with that big wall in front of you, it will dissolve, even if it's only momentarily. You will find yourself in the taking and sending and not in the emotion and the standoff. I'm going to read that sentence again. Practice this until all thought and projection falls away. Have you ever experienced that in your Dharma practice, in your taking and sending? Like, suddenly you're just doing it and you're not thinking about it. It's just like as natural as breathing. It's just what's happening in the moment. There's not even a you there. What he's describing here is when the I falls away, that sense of I. It's when you have no head, as we discussed at KDC a couple weeks ago. You're just in the awareness and not in the selfness, the egoness. So practice this until all thought and projection fall away and you are clear and awake in the experience of taking and sending. I encourage everybody to persist with practice to that extent when you can, and it will happen. It won't happen every time, but if you really, it's just getting into the zone. You get into the zone if you persist. And then you fall out of the zone and you have to do it again. And here's my favorite thing that Ken says, and then we have to stop. At the end of the chapter, he sums this up in a way that I just think is very helpful. And I put the sentence in my post. You can know what to do. He's talking about like action versus Dharma practice, engagement versus Dharma practice. You can know what to do, or I would say how to be engaged, only when you are no longer disturbed by your emotional reactions and you are free from the confusion of the conceptual mind. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for our actions to be liberated actions, actions that are not driven by negative emotions or harmful emotions. And then we can do anything we want. We can take any action if our mind is clear and our motivation is compassionate. So anybody have any last words before we do the prayers? John, I'm unmuting you. I'm trying. I can't unmute you. I
got it.
Okay.
So it seems like there's another duplicity or dichotomy or whatever you want to call it between acknowledging someone's state of mind and the karma that they're creating and letting them do it, because now you're letting someone hurt themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to do that if you can prevent them from doing it. But it's very hard to see how to intervene properly without increasing the harm if your mind isn't clear. So that is the point. We want to prevent harm if we can. But we want to do it with a clear mind, with a practitioner's mind. I don't know if that helped at all, but I think you were just basically restating. Anybody else? All right, then we'll do our prayers, dedicating all the merit from our study and discussion and contemplation today to the enlightenment of all sentient beings, who fill space. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my false, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, unto Zangpo and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication, please fulfill. So let's let our minds come to rest for another moment. Letting go of everything we've been thinking and talking about. And now I'm unmuting everybody. So I'll be on the road Saturday and be landing on Tuesday. And so I'll see you on Thursday, as always, from Richmond. All right. And again, anybody who's interested, who has the Chit Empowerment, is interested in a class, let me know. And we'll find a time that works for everybody who wants to participate. All right, I will see you all next week. Have a great week, and then we're being treated unfairly, and rejoice when it happens, because it's a great time.